So we're gonna get started. I'll be leading this section, but Doug will be chiming in as he sees fit, because he's obviously been running this course for a little bit longer than I have. But before we get started, are there any like burning questions that you need to get out before we start? Are you okay? All right. So we've mapped this CS50 curriculum to the APCSP framework, which actually ended up being a lot longer than most people would assume. It was like a 300-row spreadsheet that they had me map all of our curricular resources to their learning objectives and enduring understanding. So it's quite a process, but it's ultimately good for you because now that we are an endorsed provider, it's easier than ever for you guys to adopt this course for your own classroom. So that pink or the purple book that you guys all have is available online as a PDF. You probably have already seen it, but this is a link if you haven't. Again, we'll be posting all of our materials and slides online for you guys. And I actually just sent you all an email that had the link to that in case you missed it the first time around. Yeah. But this is essentially that book that you have in your hand. So I sent you guys all an email with those slides and whatever you may have missed earlier, you can just check back in at that Dropbox link and everything should be there for you. I'm just gonna move on for the sake of time. So there's sort of like this hierarchy of how this course is laid out. So the big topics are what College Board calls big ideas, and there are seven of those. Six of those are tested for within the exam, the only exception being creativity, because there's no real way to test that with multiple choice. So that's just one of the sort of blips that you should be aware of. Like, I wouldn't spend too much time there preparing for the multiple choice. Within those seven big ideas, we have enduring understandings, we have learning objectives, we have essential knowledge statements, and then it's just like one bigger topic with smaller subtopics, and then with like, I know how to create a for loop. Those would be like an example of essential knowledge statements. So it's really like a bigger idea, a smaller topic, and then like a statement after that. That's sort of the hierarchy of how this framework is laid out. And then we have six computational thinking practices. And these are more of like what the students are actually doing, like how they are practicing what the course requires you to do. There are two through course assignments, the create task and the explore task. The explore task is a sort of like a research assignment where students are researching different innovations in technology and explaining like how this could possibly be the future and different pros and cons of that technology. And more on that a little bit later. And then we have our multiple choice exam, which this year will be held on May 11th, 2018. And that's available on the College Board website if you need to refer back to that later. All right, so we have a bunch of big ideas, and we're just gonna go real quick through those and sort of talk about what they mean. So like I said, we have creativity. This one's hard to test multiple choice, but it is heavily featured in the create task and the explore task. How creative are students being with making a program from scratch? The College Board refers to these as computational artifacts, which I've never heard that term until they published this course. But it's just something that the student produces, some PDF, some photo that they're manufacturing via code or some other programming language.
And that phrase confuses them for months.
Yeah, so introducing that terminology early on can definitely be helpful for students. So the main focus here is, you know, finding those interesting and relevant computational artifacts. And it isn't necessarily the best word, but it's the term that they most often use. And so it's sort of referenced in a bunch of different ways. So they use written tasks as also computational artifacts because you're using a computer to create these artifacts, as well as code, as well as anything that is outputted by your code. So it's sort of a broad umbrella topic for all of that. Next you have abstraction. So abstraction and the other one are algorithms. Those are like two big sort of keywords that the College Board looks for in all of the writing portions of their through course assessments. And abstraction is sort of what we talked about earlier when you guys were drawing your algorithms with the square and the circle and the triangle. Being able to say, this is a square, rather than draw your pen down, across, up, left. is sort of what we would use as maybe like a function in computer science. And having that level of, okay, I don't need to know what this program does in my main function. I could abstract that out into a separate function. That way I can use it multiple times without having to re-implement or copy-paste that little bit of code. So here we're going to focus on modeling the world and communicating with people. So someone who may not know what a coordinate plane is in math isn't going to know the coordinate 0, 1 to 1, 1 and all of that, but they would know draw a square, right? That's easily accessible for people who don't have a background in CS. And we do encourage students to comment their code pretty heavily in our course so that even someone who doesn't understand C or Python or whatever language they're coding in would be able to look at the comments and understand what the different functions and portions of the code are doing. All right, so like I said, we sort of have these different levels of abstraction. So the first would be this very low level, right? Place your pen on paper, move it 1 inch up, move it over to the left or right, and lift your pen. So being very specific about the algorithm, using very specific language, just like how you would have to if you were coding this. And then we could maybe move up to a little bit higher level, assuming that the person knows what a coordinate grid is and using those ordered pairs. Or maybe we get down to draw a square, right? That's the most abstracted way to represent that information. So then we move on to the next big idea, which is data and information. So data and information is an interesting one. It's touched upon in a lot of our different chapters. If I will be posting the mapping to all of our curricular resources for you guys to look at if you so choose to. So you can sort of see that all the big ideas aren't clustered by chapter. Like chapter 0 doesn't represent creativity. Chapter 1 doesn't represent abstraction. They're sort of salt and peppered throughout the course so that students really have to integrate those different topics as they go, not just thinking, oh, I already did this. I don't need to know it, moving on. So here we're going to try and focus on working with data. So if you guys have gotten to some of the later PSETs, you'll notice that we use backends for some of them, like CS50 Finance or Mashup, where students have to work with a database, usernames, passwords, how to hash those so that your passwords are protected and so forth. So they're working with data sets already. Next, we move on to algorithms, which sort of pairs nicely with abstraction. So one of the things that College Boards ask students to do in their create task is identify the abstractions and the algorithms. And all the students are like, well, I don't know what those are, because College Board never takes the time to identify those specifically or define them. So what we like to say is the algorithms are those black boxes. You have some input and you have some output. So in this box is your algorithm. But this whole thing would be considered like that abstraction, right? So I like to say that the algorithm is that meaty part of your code where all of your logic is happening, whereas the abstraction is the fact that you took this part out of main, the fact that you don't need to know the direct implementation. You just know that it has some input and it outputs whatever you programmed it to do, not necessarily knowing what goes on in that black box. So we're focusing on developing those algorithms and expressing them like original algorithms, not ones that they find on the internet, although there was some miscommunication in the College Board rubric that students were actually able to use algorithms that they found online so long as they cited them. And I think that'll continue for this year, but after that, they're looking to get rid of that. So just something to keep in mind, students will have to create their own original algorithms for those create tasks. And then we move on to programming. So pretty much our implementation of this course, everything is sort of seen through the lens of programming. We talk about algorithms, we talk about it in Scratch, in C, in Python. When we talk about creativity, again, we're using that lens of programming to express our creativity. So programming sort of ties into all the other big ideas. And it's just how we can apply them in various projects and even different languages. Then we move on to the internet, which is one of the topics that a lot of teachers have sort of said, you know, I need to supplement a lot of this course with additional resources for the internet one, just because there are certain topics that students get really into in this unit, because the internet is something that they use every day. They have it in their pockets. They have their phones that get onto the internet. They're on Twitter in your class. So the internet is a topic that's really interesting. And to sort of fuel that interest with additional resources, teachers have found to be really helpful. And this is often where students create their, or do their create project through. They often create a website or a web app and sort of use the internet very heavily in that last part of the class. So they're going to gain insight not only to what you can do on the internet with web programming, but how the internet works. What happens when I go to google.com? What is my trace route? Where is this going when I send that information in? What is happening to that data? Am I going to have some like cyber hack happen if I put my password into this email that I got from the Prince of, you know, Saudi Arabia or something? So it's sort of the security aspect as well as what you can do with it. Then we have global impact. So global impact is about, all right, so we start off in C. We have this program that runs in our terminal, and we are pretty much the only ones that get to see what that outputs. Global impact is addressing the fact that, okay, if I put this on a website, if I publish this on the internet, so many more people have access to what I've created, and how can that implement change in other parts of the world? How can this sort of fire up change? And that's also a very interesting topic that students tend to dive really deeply into. So we're talking about how computing enables innovation and sort of sparking that for other students. So if some student creates a project and they publish that online, maybe that creates interest for other students to build on that. And students will get to sort of take a taste of that when they do CS50 mashup, where they get to use Google's API for maps and Google Maps, Google News and Google Maps, sort of tying those two together. And they get to use an API that already exists. They've already used Google Maps for something in their own life, maybe how to find directions, maybe plotting pins on a map. And so it's really cool to get to use those tools yourself and modify them to your own purpose. So those are our big ideas. Again, we sort of talked about this, that programming is the lens that we see all the rest of them through. So we program our creativity into a project. We program using algorithms. We program using these abstractions. So everything is sort of seen through programming. All right, so then we have those computational thinking practices. So one is connecting computing. And these computational thinking practices sort of are interlinked with the big ideas that we talked about earlier. And so this one sort of interlinks with the global impact, right? So how are we connecting these projects together? All right, and then we have creating computational artifacts, which students are gonna have to do throughout this course. And again, those computational artifacts is just that umbrella term for everything that they're doing, whether they're creating a code in C or in Scratch, all of that sort of falls under that bigger umbrella of computational artifacts. Talk about abstraction a little bit in the course. And again, all of these are tying back to those big ideas, so they're really interwoven. Most often, if you hit all those big ideas, you have also hit the computational thinking practices. They just sort of overlap really well together. Then we're gonna talk about analyzing problems and artifacts. So in the past, our problems have been, here's a long specification for the project, turn this in to your teacher, and then that's it. We've had some writing assignments thrown in there to sort of prep students for the explore task. But now we are looking in to add some questions that students have to answer at the end of all of their problem submissions so that they are practicing for that create task when they have to write, what are my abstractions? What are my algorithms? And really identifying that from the get-go. So that becomes second nature by the time the create task rolls around. And that's something that we'll probably roll out this year. Yeah. Yeah. No, we're still looking to implement that, but it'll probably be likely that it'll come out with fall resources. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're actually probably going to be embedded directly into the problem specifications. We'll probably add a questions.txt file in the distribution where those questions pre-exist for students to fill out the answers to. But it is our understanding that differentiating and identifying algorithms and abstractions was a big hurdle for students. So trying to drill that early and often, I think will make a big difference by the time the create task comes in. So we'll probably even see it directly in the specs themselves.
Yeah. And then we have communicating. So this is, how do I articulate my ideas? More often than not, this comes into play when we talk about commenting your code. How am I communicating to my teacher that I understand what this for loop is doing, that I'm just not copying this off of GitHub or some other repo that I found online, and making them comment so that they are also aware of what their thought process was, and maybe even starting with comments. Maybe instead of just jumping right into a problem, you have them write all the comments first. First, I want to do this, then I want to do this, then trying to find the, I guess, correct implementation from turning that pseudocode that they just wrote into actual code. And on that note, the last sort of computational thinking practice is collaborating. So one of the big focuses is that code.org has been trying to push is pair programming. And that's sort of where either one person is just typing and the other one is sort of coming up with those ideas and maybe switching roles. That's one sort of way to do it. But collaborating can just be discussing an idea with your classmate. College Board does allow collaboration for the different tasks, the create task and the explore task. However, they are only able to collaborate up until the point of implementation. They can have that same idea, but they need to implement it separately. Yeah. Oh, yeah, on the Explorer, it's a research writing. And I mean, there's nothing stopping them from picking the same innovations, yeah. But again, they need to turn in separate work. Yeah.
For the implementation, you said like
they could have the same idea for a create task, but they need to code it themselves.
They code the parts of the same program.
Yes. Yeah. They could implement different functions that work together to do one thing, but they would turn in their work. The full implementation, I believe, correct? If they collaborate?
If they collaborate, they turn in the full implementation, and then they have to identify which aspects of it they yep. did.
And in their write-up, they would say, I did this.
I did this.
Not we
Don't
did.
Say, I did this thing that we did together.
Yeah.
Which cost a couple of students
yeah.
that we're aware of, really take ownership of the part that they did.
Yeah. So have your students stray away from we did and turn to I did. So again, those through course assessments, we have our explore task, and College Board regulates how many hours you need to spend in your classroom addressing these different tasks. The explore task needs to take up 8 classroom hours. It doesn't necessarily mean that the student is working on that. It just means that you need to say, hey, today is a work day. You can work on your explore task, and that'll count. Yeah?
Classroom hours, 60 minutes.
Classroom hours, yes.
60, based on 60 minutes.
So
our periods are 50 minutes, so I have to give like 11 or
yep.
12.
Yeah. So long as it adds up to 8 hours. Yeah. I mean, there's no way for them to really check. But you have to sign off that you gave that to your students. Yeah. Students in this task are researching current issues in technology and investigating those implementations, sort of addressing those pros and cons. I think some people use self-driving cars, drones. So try and come up with, have your students come up with interesting topics, because the people who are grading them don't want to see like the same thing talked about over and over again. Try and stay away from those buzz topics at the time, especially just because you want your students to have variety, and maybe that they're presenting their presentations to the class on what they did on Explore. So just sort of having that variety within your class is going to be really helpful for your students. And this counts towards 16% of their overall AP score. So at the end of the school year, after the students take their exam, you will only receive like their final score, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. You won't know what came from Explore or Create or from the multiple choice, but do know that it is 16% of their overall Yeah. The create task needs to take up 12 classroom hours. So that's a pretty lengthy one. We typically have teachers start at least introducing that in January, just so that, like, even though they're not at the point in the course where they've done web development yet, they can sort of start thinking about what they want to do, maybe even just brainstorming ideas, and that can sort of count towards your classroom hours. And just thinking about what the possibilities may be rather than implementing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then
doing
a hackathon to get some of those hours.
Yeah.
If you're concerned about it.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, for sure.
If after school hackathon counts towards classroom hours, not, I don't think it was after school.
Yeah.
Because if we have permission to leave, like, for
the school, school time.
So this one is creating, like, a computational artifact. They are choosing some problem to solve, so it's completely open-ended. That's sort of where they're addressing that creativity big idea. This one is 24% of their overall score. So the majority of their score is, in fact, coming from the multiple choice exam at the end. We've played around with where to place these tasks in our own curriculum, and a lot of teachers have found that placing the explore task very early on, like right after you do Scratch or even chapter zero of our implementation, is so helpful because you don't want to have that break once you start coding. Once you start coding, you don't want your students to have to take 8 classroom hours and then they sort of forget, like, oh, how do I use printf? How do I make a for loop? And it sort of disrupts the flow of your classroom. So front loading that explore task is probably the way to go. The second one we try to have teachers do as early as they can, just because it takes 12 classroom hours, which is a lot of time. And all of the tasks have to be turned in by April 30th, I believe, or the last Friday of April.
The code.org version, you go in and you do lesson 1, lesson 2, lesson 3. I didn't get to explore until January.
Yeah.
Right after their midterms. And then you have to give them, for me, it was 6 classes in a row. And then I found by the time I finished the next unit, I was crashing into the create.
Yeah, so you definitely want to front load that.
Yeah, we're recommending officially now that students focus on Explore starting in October, just to get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
And then Create would map pretty closely to our final project. So we would generally recommend that starting in like March. By that point, students have had some exposure to some web development stuff, so they can go on to create something web oriented if they want to. Right, yeah.
I ran into snow days.
Yeah.
And that just...
that probably throws us off, yeah.
The deadline was just crashing faster and faster.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So addressing that as early as you feel comfortable is probably your best game plan there. Again, even if they're not implementing it, really brainstorming, you know, the different functions that they're going to have to build, what sort of platform it's going to run on, whether they're going to code it in C or Python, and sort of mapping that out early. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Related back to programming. So on your curriculum, it says PHP.
We're changing it to Python. Yeah.
And then for Scratch, or are you using Snap?
We use Scratch. But I mean, it's totally up to you whether you want to follow that or not. You can totally have your students build it in Snap.
So that's not
it's not. All right, and then we come to the AP exam. So if you guys have audited your course as an AP exam, you should have received access to a practice test. So this is going to be that big chunk of where their score comes. It's 60% of their overall test score. It's a two-hour exam, which is relatively short for an AP exam. Most of them tend to be longer, but that's because we have through-course assessments for AP CSP. It's about 74 multiple-choice questions. Some of them are those, like, pick two from this list type deal. They cover the six out of the seven, like I addressed earlier. And these are sort of the breakdowns of what big ideas they hit. So 20% from algorithms and programming, 18% of abstraction and data information, 12% of the internet and global impact. So AP CSP is actually language agnostic, meaning that you can teach this course in whatever language you want, and it shouldn't hinder your students when they come to the test. So you might be asking, well, how are they including 20% on programming? Well, College Board has their own sort of language, almost. I think it's referred to as a reference sheet in your purple books, and it's how it's sort of like a Scratch type language where it has the same constructs of like a for loop or an if block and that sort of thing, creating a list and how you would move a robot on this grid and that sort of thing. So definitely useful to show your students this before the multiple choice test and have them get familiar with it, but it will be provided as a resource while they're taking the test. Similar to in an AP math course, how they have that sort of list of formulas, they'll have this reference sheet with them. All right, so now we're gonna sort of shift gears and start talking about our curriculum, specifically our implementation of how this course would work. So let's take a look at that. We have 9 chapters. So 7 are what we refer to as core chapters, or the ones that we believe are essential, and 2 fast track chapters, which maybe you assign to some students in your class, maybe you have all of your students in your class do it, but they're not necessary for the AP exam at the end of the term. That's where we sort of address pointers and data structures, memory management, all of that sort of gets tackled in fast track. So again, we have resources for all of this, which Doug has sort of shown us in our curriculum session. We also have written resources and demo ideas for you guys to use, similar how to David does the PB&J algorithms demo, if you're familiar with that, or the phone book demo, where we're doing binary search in a phone book and like ripping the problem in half, and all of that. This is currently what the teachers look like, but as Doug mentioned earlier, these are going to be getting a facelift. So right now we have chapters on the left side and modules on the right side. Chapters are those 9 chapters, the 7 core and the 2 fast track, and the modules are sort of topics within those. And then we'll have listed for you all of the resources by resource type. So all the videos are sort of chunked together, written resources are chunked together. We have learning objectives and the essential understandings listed there, but you can totally feel free to turn that off because you might not want your students to be overwhelmed with a page of like a million learning objectives that I've mapped them to, and some thought questions that they might want to answer before moving on. So if you go to the resources tab on the left, and again, this is changing, so it might look a little bit different come fall, but we have all the resources listed by type. And as a teacher, once you register for an account and after I approve it, you'll have access to some of the latter resource types, such as Private for Teachers, Sample Solutions. So Private for Teachers, that topic is, it's grading guidelines, what to look for in terms of design and style in your student's code, whereas Sample Solutions are just links to Dropbox where we've saved the staff solutions on our end. But we're looking to move all of that over to GitHub. So if you haven't created a GitHub account yet, I encourage you to do so. And in fact, we will be needing them for tomorrow's session. So at some point today, maybe create one. And then we have 50 or so problems in the course. We have 2 different types. We have writing and programming problems. So the writing problems are used to sort of prepare students for that explore task. And those are chapter 0 problems. This is like the first thing that they do. They're working on writing, researching. And we encourage you to give as much feedback as you can in our writing assignments, because you are not allowed to give your students feedback on their explore task. You're not allowed to sort of do a back and forth edit with them It's they have to create it and then submit it. You're not allowed to sort of have that one-on-one time with your students on that. Yeah. I don't believe you are allowed to give them a grade.
Okay. You are not allowed until they say final and midterm. They will like to, they submit it to you. You can't see it, you can't change anything, you can't comment. And then maybe they will finalize their essay at the end in April. Mm-hmm. And then when they submit its final and the, when the time's over, you start grading them if you want to. To make it serious, it's better to grade. Otherwise, they can just, you know.
Yeah. So, College Board has a, I think it's called Digital Portfolio, and that's going to be the platform that students will be submitting their explore task and their create task on. And so you as a teacher have to set that up, and your students will submit to your classroom's digital portfolio. Yes?
Because I believe as part of the digital portfolio, you are required to certify that you did not provide feedback. So I think once it has gotten past that point, I think it's fine to assess it however you want, if you want to count it for a grade in your class. But I think until then, it's safe to just be as hands-off as possible on it, just so that nobody gets caught in some...
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, yeah. I mean, it's safe. It's safer not to. You could probably grade it as like, yes, they submitted it, no, they did not. Yeah. 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 So it'd be binary, 0 or 1. Yeah. All right, so again, this we offer different variations. So similar to the college course, we have less and more comfortable versions. If you guys have done Mario on edX, there's a less comfortable version and a more comfortable, and we'll allow you guys to give both versions to your students so that they can pick what task do I want to do. Where the essential thing that they're supposed to be learning is addressed in both. So students who do the less comfy version don't need to feel like, hey, I didn't learn what the kid who did the more comfy did. And they're totally free to do both if they want to and turn in the less comfortable, which I know some students will do just because they want the grade, right, of getting a better grade if they do less comfy. And so our version of a final project maps really well to what the AP Create task is. All of the rubrics and that sort of thing are found in those purple books that you guys have in your hand. Again, it can also be found online. And I believe on the College Board website, they have some sample tasks that you guys can look at, where they're, I think they group them into like high, medium, and low scores. They don't actually tell you what the actual score was. They just sort of say, hey, this is really good, this is not so good. So less helpful, but still helpful to see some examples of what they are. So here are our chapters. We start off with computers and computing. So it's sort of addressing hardware of what is physically in your computer. And this goes into some sample topics like what does it mean to compute? How do we define what a computer actually is? Is a sundial a computer? And answering these sort of questions like what does it mean to call something a computer? So here we address abstraction and algorithms. So we talk about okay, I'm moving my mouse on my computer. What is that doing at a very low level in the computer? What zeros and ones are sort of changing? And then, oh, on the screen, it's showing me this. That's sort of the higher level abstraction there. And then we talk about algorithms, but again, this is very basic. We talk about algorithms in the sense of describing things with words, like how we did in the drawing exercises earlier. In this, we have students address or do some writing problems. Like there's one called Everyday Algorithms where students have to describe the steps for brushing their teeth in the morning or something like that, and using very specific language to do so to get them ready for programming in C or even in Scratch. Next we move on to building blocks of programming. So this is where we start scratch, right? We're starting to implement those logic blocks. Scratch is coming out with a 3.0 version, so that'll likely change January next year?
I think the target is January of 2018.
2018. So probably not so helpful for this year, but in the future, it will be changing. So here's where they sort of have to pseudocode their algorithms, and then later on turn that into real code. They address variables here, loops here, conditionals, and sort of the concept-wise, what those are, and then later on they implement those. So a lot of the early piece sets like Water, Mario, all of those sort of address these very early topics. Then we talk about putting those blocks together. So we've learned fundamentally what different logic I have access to when I'm coding. Well, how can I use that to make something a little bit more interesting than printf hello world? So we talk about functions, arrays, user interfaces, debugging. In debugging, we have that tool debug50. You guys will get to play with that a little bit later today. Functions, so really early on, how do I create a function? How do I create that abstraction? And maybe even a function that calls another function, if you are so inclined to have that level in your classroom. Arrays, what sort of benefits do I have from getting an array? What are my limitations in using an array? And again, really addressing abstraction multiple times in our curriculum so that students are very familiar with that term. Then we talk about thinking computationally. So sorting, searching, efficiency, can a computer solve any problem? And this is really a question that is addressed in the College Board framework, unsolvable problems. Can I solve everything with a computer? And the answer is no. And there are certain corner cases that you can explore with your students that are pretty interesting to think about, like the Turing halting problem. Can you predict in finite time whether a program will halt or not given a certain input? And so here we sort of address data and information when we're talking about sorting and searching. So how do I search through an array? What might be the best way to search? Do I want to use linear or binary? And again, with those sorting algorithms, do I want to use bubble sort or insertion sort? And what sort of data lends itself well to that particular algorithm? Then we get into sort of the more nitty-gritty design and elegance efficiency. So data encapsulation, creating our own structs and sort of building those data types ourselves. Maybe I want to collect information from a student, and I want their name, I want their ID number, and I want their favorite flavor of ice cream. Well, those three things don't really make sense in the context of, okay, here's an array of string names. Here's an array of string ID number, or int ID numbers, right? So they only make sense in the context of that whole thing is considered a student. So sort of building that data type of a student so that you can store these in a more efficient way and search them in a more efficient way. It could be addressing creativity. A lot of these sort of address multiple things, but we sort of try to filter out the most addressed big ideas, but definitely, yeah. This is still in C. So the end of C is in those fast track chapters. If you decide to do that, that's where pointers and data structures are addressed. But if you don't, right after, I believe in edX, it would be recover. Right after that, you would move into the Python stuff. Then we move into our first fast track chapter. And you'll notice that the core chapters are numbered, whereas the fast track chapters are lettered, so that's just to sort of give you an idea of what is essential versus what is optional. So the first one is managing data, and this is where we talk about those data structures. If you're on misspellings, that pset in the edX course, we talk about trees, tries, hash tables, all of that good stuff, pointers, and this is something that is not covered on the AP CSP exam, so you don't need to cover this if you don't want to. If you have students who have some CS background, it's definitely awesome to point them to these resources and have them sort of tackle that on their own so that they don't feel held up by the rest of the class. And then we move into developer's toolbox. So this is another optional chapter, and definitely don't feel tied down to do both. If you just want to do chapter A or if you just want to do chapter B as an optional chapter, that's totally cool too. You know what works best for your students. Like, we don't know your classroom specifically. So it's totally up to you on how you want to use these chapters and sort of integrate them in. Some people have asked us, I know that I don't have time before the AP exam to do these optional chapters. Can I do them at the end of the year? I have all of May. And the answer is yes and no, sort of. Yes, you're totally free to use these chapters in whatever order you choose to do. But all of the optional chapters are in that low-level language of C. And so after students learn Python, there's a very low chance they are going to want to go back and write in C after they have used Python. So just something to keep in mind if you plan on doing those optional chapters. Yeah, they'll definitely appreciate Python and all the things that they get to take for granted that they had to build from scratch in C. We move on to networking and the internet. And this is sort of where that transition point comes in. We start talking about HTML and CSS, the different sort of implications of using the internet, like cybersecurity, cyber attacks, researching different attacks that have happened, and even pulling in some current events. Like, there's that Google Docs phishing scam where you were getting emails to be shared on a Google Doc, and it was actually just to get your username and password. So sort of pulling in what's happening now so that students see this has implications in my life right now. And then lastly, problem solving in an interconnected world is where they really start to use those web programming languages like Python. So this is actually what is currently on our site. We have PHP, JavaScript, and sort of problems that we face today that we might not necessarily have an answer for yet. But we want students to think about those more in depth. But we will have the Python versions available for you guys this year. If you feel so inclined to use PHP, definitely email us and we can provide you with those resources. But we will be trying to steer everyone towards the direction of Python. There is a better sort of toolbox of Python resources than PHP. It's a little more outdated. And Python has some really great sort of training wheels to start kids on. We have a Python library, a CS50 Python library, so students can recreate Greedy and Mario all using Python and sort of use that as sort of wading into the water of the more complex topics in Python. So that's all of our chapters. Here's sort of what we predict, how long these will take. Obviously, if you have a different timeline, I think this was based off of what?
This is a 36-week timeline, yeah.
The low numbers?
No, the high numbers.
The high numbers? And the low numbers are based off of
I think a
32?
Doing the math in my head again. Oh. It's 30, but it counts for the tasks.
Yeah. So it's just a rough sort of schedule. Again, if you have some like weird schedule, or maybe you see your students only on Mondays, but you see them for the whole day, or if you see them every day for like half an hour, you can totally feel free to email us and sort of say, hey, my schedule doesn't really line up with what you guys predicted. How can I format this better for my own classroom? And we'll try and help you out there. So again, those chapters A and B, you totally don't need to do them. If you're running short on time, like, they're not necessary. So you can cut those out. And it might even be worth it to spend a little bit more time in design, elegance, and efficiency, and even problem solving for an interconnected world where they're doing that web development stuff using Python and Flask even to build those websites.
Basically, without the AMD, you're saying it takes about 28 weeks?
It could.
I mean, it really does vary based on the number of students, but yes, at the high end of things, we would estimate that it would take 28 weeks. Leaving those two chapters out.
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, we are an endorsed provider for College Board, so it should be relatively easy for you to go on to College Board, audit your course, and say, I want to use CS50's curriculum. If there's any trouble, like, you can feel free to email us, and we will sort of help you out getting through that process. Yeah.
I just want to go back to 28 weeks. So does that 28 weeks include the
That is not included in the 28 weeks, but there's the extra time because it doesn't fill the full 36 or 32 or whatever. That's what that is intended for.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you totally end up with that extra sort of time in May after the exam. And we've had teachers who have students build on whatever they turn in for the create task, adding some more functionality to that, or even creating like the walkthrough videos themselves and giving that to their students for the following year, which I thought was a cool idea. So you can definitely like play around with that time or even go into like mobile app development or do whatever you want to do with that last sort of month of time.
And that is also, again, a high-end estimate of every single unit, which I don't think would occur. I think that, well, each unit also contains like a number, as I mentioned earlier, multiple iterations of the same problem. Some teachers will issue all of the problems. Some might issue only a subset of them, in which case the amount of time it would take would get shorter.
And if I could, the other 28 weeks based upon how many hours per week teaching?
180.
I don't know, in 1 week.
180 minutes per week.
Two classes of 84 minutes or three classes of 84 minutes. So
okay.
Is yours based on?
It's 180 minutes. I was doing the math in my head. It's 45. The average case is a 45 minute period times four. So it's based on 180 minutes. So it sounds like on average you have 160 and then you have 220. So like alternating, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Is the timeline, the test is in May. Mm-hmm. Now there's 6 weeks we need to do the practice for this. So teaching should be not like over 36 weeks. It should be like until like 22. If you count the days, whatever after May don't really count. Like you just do it for like further, artificial intelligence or whatever you want to do after May, it's not going to count for your AP course. It's
right.
Going to be counting extra. So what I realized this year and I came to this workshop is the timeline is set up 30 weeks or 36 weeks is actually too much. Like we have to finish everything before, way before, cover everything, including the performance tests too, so that we can be sure that the kids are ready for the test in May.
So we do not explicitly call out a test review period. I know you mentioned it earlier. We include a lot of code examples where students are seeing the reference sheet kind of things and the types of multiple choice questions in the questions that we recommend teachers ask. Some of them will show up in questions.txt files that are part of the problem set submissions. So we try and integrate the multiple choice aspect of the test review throughout the course as opposed to it being a block. I know that many folks will want to teach to the test and spend that time. If you feel like there is a time constraint, let us know and we can recommend things to adjust or change to give you if you want like all of April for the test review or something like that. Then we can propose a different alternative for 25 weeks or 23 weeks. Just let us know and we can help like craft that.
Yeah, for sure. And so this is going to be the site that you guys will be using to view those teacher sites that we talked about earlier. And just to keep solutions and some of the teacher resources a little bit more private, we do ask that you provide some verification that you are a teacher. Some people just tell me, it's my email address. Like I have @aschoolname.edu. Typically students also have those same types of domains, so we don't consider that secure enough as proof of teacher status. We do ask for either a link to your teacher blog or a staff directory page just to see that you are a registered teacher. But if you're here today, you can definitely put in that you attended the July workshop 2017, and that'll help me expedite the approving process for teacher accounts on our portal.